The Assassin.
You know I break necks, call me Jack Tate. I have no regrets while your life is fading. I'm a crazy fuck equivalent to Satan. When I'm behind the mic, I feel like the greatest. You know I break necks, call me Jack Tate. I have no regrets while your life is fading. I'm a crazy fuck equivalent to Satan. When I'm behind the mic, I feel like the greatest.
What up, y'all? You're listening to Sports Talk with Trop, and I'm your host, Katie Trop. Well, here we are, episode 100 of Sports Talk with Trop. How fucking crazy is that? Really, thanks to everybody who's been listening from the beginning or just hopped on at some point or just listens to me at random occasions or just when I'm talking certain sports or whatever. Really appreciate everybody listening. It's been cool to see, especially that I've been getting, listened to in really random places. I always find it amusing. It doesn't look like somebody's listening to me regularly in the Middle East, but I always find it amusing when both my music and my podcasts are being streamed in like Middle Eastern countries, because I'm like, who the fuck is allowing my ass to be listened to over there? Because we all know how Middle Easterners just love women over there. I'm sure even just listening to me, they just want to chop my fucking clit off right then and there. But yeah, and it's just weird. I just every time I see it, if somebody's listening to my music especially. But I mean, I guess both versions, because I mean, I swear on this, I'm completely brash, I'm an asshole, and I'm most certainly not what Middle Eastern men like in women. That's for damn sure. I could obviously never even step foot in a Middle Eastern country. I mean, they would be ready to chop my clit off and murder me the second I land in that place. Because if you don't know, I'm a fucking bitch who does not act accordingly ever. And as a matter of fact, I'm like the opposite type of person. If there's something about me that bothers you, I accentuate it times a million if I know that. So, yeah, like I said, even if I were to fly over the Middle East, they'd probably have fucking missiles ready just to shoot my ass. But hey, shout out to everybody who's listening, and I really appreciate it. And we still have a month left to go of this year, but don't think I'm stopping, because I enjoy sports and I enjoy talking sports. So with that being said, let's get into fantasy football. It is that time of year, people. Fantasy football playoffs are starting to begin. And in one of my two fantasy football leagues, we did start the fantasy football playoffs this week. My team is, of course, Crazy Crackers. I went 22-4 on the season, and I'm up against Lemmy Burrow Adala. Now, let me tell you something about this. I've been absolutely dominating both of my fantasy football leagues, but this league in particular, I've been in first place from the fucking jump. So I'm going to be really fucking pissed off if I lose this league, especially because money's on the line too. I've absolutely just stomped all these dudes into oblivion. And this is my first year in this league, too, so it's just fucking awesome. So hopefully I'm able to maintain this dominance and I actually walk away with the win. But I don't get too cocky. It doesn't matter if you're the first, if you've been dominating the regular season in fantasy sports. It's happened to me so many times where I've dominated the regular season and the first fucking round of the playoffs, I lose. And that just pisses me off. Now, in this league, the way our playoffs work is we play 2 weeks for one round. So I have this week and next week against Lemmy Burrow Adala. So we'll see. I should get the win. I mean, I've got a really stacked ass team, but hey, you never know what's going to happen in fantasy sports. But like I said, I'm going to be pissed the fuck off if I do not win this league in particular, because my domination has been insane and I want to keep it that way. So let's get into the Thursday night football matchup. Holy fucking shit. I mean, there's two ways you can look at this game. So first of all, it was the Las Vegas Raiders at the Los Angeles Rams. Baker Mayfield was just picked up off of waivers by the Rams this week. And by this week, I mean 2 days ago. So there were rumblings that Baker was going to come into the game, but turns out Baker came into the game in the second series and played the entire game. And for a dude who doesn't know anybody on this team, hasn't played with anybody on this team, has no rep with anybody on this team, doesn't know their plays, doesn't know their play calling, doesn't know shit about this team, he played pretty damn fucking well last night. I mean, don't get me wrong. I don't think Baker Mayfield has any type of future in the NFL other than just being the next journeyman quarterback. But good for him. Like, he came out last night and he played better than expected. I mean, a dude in that role, you just kind of expect him to come out and hopefully he'll do something for you. Nah, this dude led the comeback. Now, in my personal opinion, I'll give him his props, but this was all on the Las Vegas Raiders choking hard again. What is with this team? I swear, like, the Raiders want to be that team who's just known for fucking losing, and not just losing, but losing in the most heartbreaking fashion. I mean, that it's not even just this season. It's been the Raiders' way of life. For, like, they got to change their slogan from just win, baby, to just choke, baby. Because, I mean, wow. They dominated this game from start to finish. Now, let me just say, this was a total snooze fest for the first three quarters. It was 16-3. The Raiders went into halftime up 13-3. It was a very sloppy game from both teams. Penalties up the ass. Just really stupid turnovers, just really stupid things that hampered both teams. And it was like, does either team want to win? And I mean, really, if you look at the stat lines, it looks like Baker Mayfield was the only one who fucking showed up last night. So that was just odd. But I mean, it was so mind-blowing to me to watch the Raiders blow this because, you know, it was one thing for the Rams to get a touchdown and score and cut the lead to 16-10. But at that point in the game, I was like, well, you know what? The Raiders have been going through Josh Jacobs just like they need to. He should be able to get them a first down, can he? Nah. The Raiders get the ball back, and it's a three and out. They had to punt the ball. Now there's only like a minute something left. It might have been right before the two-minute warning. Regardless, there wasn't a lot of fucking time on the clock. So Raiders, man, they should have had this. I mean, they did get some good pressure on Baker Mayfield really all night. I mean, dude took some hits. So you're thinking, oh yeah, this Raiders defense has to come out and do something. And actually, they did. But the big mistake was actually on their coach, Josh McDaniels. Now, in hindsight, when it happened, you can't blame him. So there was a play that was it was a third and three, and the Rams did not convert it. But on that particular play, there actually was a holding call against the Rams, which would have pushed them back 10 yards, but they would have got another chance on that third down. So Josh McDaniels declines the penalty because he wants it to be fourth down. And I don't blame him because just kind of the way things were going, you could see that the Rams were getting good chunks of yardage, especially like Baker just was getting first downs on third downs. And so the Rams were going to come in and punt, and they did come in and punt. What ended up happening is the Raiders would go off sides. And so it's fourth and three. And when you go off sides, that gives the other team 5 yards. So basically not taking that penalty cost them on that drive and would just keep the drive going. And the Rams would eventually score. And it was just actually crazy because, you know, when the Raiders punted, it was actually a great punt. They punted them, I think, at like their own 3-yard line. So you're thinking there's no fucking way the Rams are going to be able to drive down the field. And they just did. And it was just crazy to see. But a lot of it was because the Raiders had a couple of really dumbass penalties. And they got blown up on a few plays. And they set the Rams up into scoring position. And Baker Mayfield led the comeback, and the Rams got the win 17-16. So in my eyes, the Raiders absolutely choked. They had this game in the bag. Really, they were riding pretty the whole fucking way, and they just got in their own way with the dumbass penalties, and eventually Baker Mayfield would lead them back, and the Rams got a huge win. I mean, it was hilarious even to see Sean McVay, the coach of the Rams, when they scored that touchdown, like, it was like they won the Super Bowl, because it was almost like they just couldn't believe that that shit happened. I mean, the Rams season is going absolutely nowhere, so they really had nothing to lose in this picking up Baker Mayfield, and shit, look what happened. They fucked up the Raiders season, that's for damn sure, but the Raiders do it again. They choked away another fucking win, and I mean, it's just the story of their season, so shout out to the Raiders for giving me a great laugh last night. Let's move on to the rest of week 14, beginning with the afternoon games on Sunday. We have the New York Jets at the Buffalo Bills. Right now, the Bills are a 9.5-point favorite. You know, it looks like Mike White, he's continuing to be the starting quarterback that everybody wants in New York. And even though they lost last week, he still had a very solid game, and really was just those couple of interceptions he had that really fucked them up. But other than that, the Jets are a pretty solid team. Their defense is looking really good. They actually did get the win last time against Buffalo, but I think it's going to be a different story this time around. I do think it's going to be a close game just because the Jets' defense is really good, and I just kind of feel like it's going to be a close game throughout. But I feel like Buffalo's the better team. I feel like Buffalo will get the better of the Jets in the end. It could be one of those games where it comes down to a last drive of the game or a last field goal or some weird play. But I feel like Buffalo's going to get the win 24-20. Then the Cleveland Browns are at the Cincinnati Bengals. Right now, the Bengals are a 4.5-point favorite. Now, in the Joe Burrow era in Cincinnati, he has never beat the Browns. For some odd reason, the Browns are able to get it going against him. But I think that's going to change this time around. You could just tell the Bengals are ready to roll. They are getting on that hot streak. I don't think it's going to stop. And I definitely don't think it's going to stop against the Browns. Just because the Browns got a really fluky win last week. And I just don't think, especially with the addition of Deshaun Kutson as their quarterback, who looked absolutely atrocious last week, I just kind of feel like he's going to make too many mistakes. And they're not going to be able to overcome them because this Cincinnati Bengals team is a lot more potent than that shitty Houston Texans team they were playing last week. So I actually think the Bengals are going to go off in this game. And not only are they going to get the win, but I think they're just going to dominate from start to finish. And I think Joe Burrow is finally going to get over that Cleveland Browns curse and beat the Browns 28-10. Then the Houston Texans are at the Dallas Cowboys. And right now the Cowboys are a 16.5-point favorite. Yeah, 16.5-point favorite, which, I mean, honestly, sounds about right because the Texans are just awful. I don't even know what is going on with the Texans. They don't have, like, one good player to discuss. They don't have any type of future to discuss other than they are going to be the first pick in the draft, which is basically the case for them every fucking year. So it's like, what good does that do them at this point? Whereas the Cowboys are in the exact opposite direction. They are actually a legit team. And I just kind of feel like this team is going to just suffocate the Texans. And I think it's just going to be straight up Dallas domination, 41-7. Then the Minnesota Vikings are at the Detroit Lions. And right now, Minnesota is a 0.5-point favorite over the Lions, which basically is not really anybody as a favorite in this one, which is just very odd because, you know, the Vikings are 10-2. But it's just funny because obviously all of us are having our reservations about how good the Vikings are. It's just more like you got to kind of prove it to us. And the Lions are a scrappy team. So I do expect this to be a good game. But I feel like this is going to be a high scoring offensive game where I feel like it's going to be back and forth between Jared Goff and Kirk Cousins. And it's really just going to be who has the ball last. And I feel like Minnesota, I feel like they're good enough. And while this is a division opponent, they could easily lose to them. I feel like Minnesota's probably pissed off that everybody's sliding them against the Lions of all teams this week. And so I think Minnesota will eke out the win 31-27, but I do think it'll be a close one. Then the Jacksonville Jaguars are at the Tennessee Titans. Right now, the Titans are a 3.5-point favorite. Both of these teams are pretty underwhelming. The Titans seem to be just, you know, I've never really bought into them. I think they're a good team, but they're just a team who's never been able to put it together and have, like, this identity, like, you know, like the Chiefs. When you play the Chiefs, you pretty much expect a good game from them, and you never can count them out. Whereas the Titans, once shit gets away from them, they're done for. And the Jaguars are just not that good of a team. You could tell that they're building. You could tell that they're moving forward in the right direction, but they're just not that good of a team. Now, this is a division battle, so I do expect it to be a close game because I don't really think either team's going to be capable of blowing either one of these teams out. But I think since the Titans are at home, I feel like they've gone away from Derrick Henry the last couple of weeks, and it really hasn't helped them out. So I think they're going to go back to Derrick Henry. The defense is going to step it up, and I think they're going to get a close win, 21-17. Then the Philadelphia Eagles are at the New York Giants. Right now, the Eagles are a 6.5-point favorite. The Giants are also a team that are coming back down to earth. I never bought into the Giants. And now it's starting to show why I never bought into the Giants. They're probably going to make the playoffs just because they were able to get a lot of those solid wins at the beginning of the season, but I don't expect them to be a postseason threat. Whereas the Eagles are more than likely going to be the number one seed unless they really start to stumble here the next month. But so far, they've been pretty consistent. They've been a very good team. This is a division battle, so I don't really expect Philadelphia to run away with this one, but I feel like it's going to be one of those games where it's close in the beginning, but then the Eagles are able to start to pull away in the second half, and I feel like the Eagles are going to get the win 24-14. And then the Baltimore Ravens are at the Pittsburgh Steelers. Right now, the Steelers are a half-point favorite, so it's basically a pretty... coin toss in this matchup here. And that's mostly because Lamar Jackson, he's not going to be playing in this one. So I expect this to be a pretty typical Pittsburgh-Baltimore game where it's just going to be defense all the way. We're probably just going to have a bunch of field goals for the most part. But right now the Steelers are trending in the right direction. They don't really have much of an identity, but it seems like they're starting to put together something pretty decent. And Baltimore, they haven't looked good. Even in their wins these last couple of weeks, they haven't looked good. And so no Lamar Jackson, I think, is going to really cost them. So I expect this to be a low-scoring, boring affair from Baltimore and Pittsburgh. But I got the Steelers winning this one 16-10. Moving on to the late afternoon games, we have the Kansas City Chiefs at the Denver Broncos. Right now, the Chiefs are an 8.5-point favorite. And really, this one is a no-brainer to me just because the Broncos are awful. They haven't been good at all this season. They haven't been able to get it going whatsoever offensively. Whereas the Chiefs just continue to be the Chiefs. Patrick Mahomes is having probably his greatest season of his career so far. He leads the league in every goddamn quarterback category possible. And I really expect the Chiefs to roll over the Denver Broncos in this one 30-13. Then I think this is going to be the game of the week, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers at the San Francisco 49ers. Right now the Niners are a 3.5-point favorite. It's kind of amusing to me because usually when a team comes in with a backup quarterback, everybody's down on them. But for some fucking reason, the 49ers are just getting all this goddamn clout. Not saying they don't deserve it. They do have a very good team. But I'm sorry. I'm here to say this right here and right now. You can quote me on this. The San Francisco 49ers will not be winning a Super Bowl with a third-string rookie Mr. Irrelevant quarterback. He might be able to game manage a few of these games at the end of the season. They may even get a playoff win depending on who they go up against. But there's no way that this Brock Purdy motherfucker is going to come in and look amazing and even really be half the quarterback that Jimmy Garoppolo is. So sorry, that's just my take on it. I know everybody thinks you can't count them out because of Brock Purdy and all of a sudden he's the greatest quarterback of all time, but it's like, nah, I'm sorry. The Niners will have their struggles. But lucky for them, they're playing the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, who are an awful team. I've pretty much given up on the Bucs just because defensively they're getting blown up. And offensively, they have no identity. I mean, Tom Brady's running for his life because the offensive line is trash. He's even had some really just bad throws himself. His receivers are dropping passes. So I don't know if the Buccaneers are going to be able to put a good enough game together to beat a team like the Niners. I mean, the Niners have one of the best defenses in the league. You know, Nick Bosa, he leads the league in sacks right now. It's just every quarterback is running for their life. And I just kind of feel like that's what's going to be the difference in this game. It's just the Niners are going to put a shit ton of pressure on Tom Brady. And he's just not going to, he's just going to have a very frustrating day. I do think it's going to be a close game because I think Brock Purdy's going to struggle as well. I think he's going to make some mistakes and I think he's going to cost his team some points on the board. So I do think it's going to be a close game. If Jimmy Garoppolo were playing, I actually wouldn't think it would be that close of a game just because the Buccaneers are just not good. The Buccaneers are only going to make the playoffs this year because of how awful the rest of the teams in their division are. And also because they have Tom Brady. I mean, no matter how down of a season he's having, if this is a down season in your entire fucking 20-year career, well, I'll take that down season. And I'm sure a lot of other quarterbacks throughout the history of time will take this, quote, down season that Tom Brady's having. Because it's not technically a down season. It's just not what we're used to seeing from Tom Brady. But hey, it's football and the struggle is real in football, even if you're Tom Brady. So I do expect this to be a close game, but I just think the Niners defense is going to be too much for this awful offensive line of the Bucs. And the Bucs have had their issues with penalties this year too. They've been that same type of team where it's like they'll get a first down, but then they'll get brought back and have that first down taken away because of some dumb holding call or some shit like that. And that just kind of seems to be a huge issue for them this season, and the Niners are a team you can't really have those type of mistakes against. And so I think the Niners will get a close win 20-17. Then the last afternoon game is the Carolina Panthers at the Seattle Seahawks. Right now the Seahawks are a 5.5-point favorite, and the Seahawks just really haven't fallen off. I've been waiting for them to fall off, and in my opinion, it looks like the Seahawks are a legit playoff contender. Hell, I think they could even possibly still win their division. We'll see what happens. I mean, they will be playing the Niners next week, so that's going to be a big battle between those two for the division. But I really think the Seattle Seahawks are a legit team. I mean, defensively, nobody's really talking about how good they are on the defensive side of the ball. But they are getting takeaways, they are getting sacks, and they are getting stops. And then you take a look at them on the offensive side of the ball. Geno Smith is one of the most efficient quarterbacks of the year. Their ground attack is very solid. And then you have Lockett and Metcalf as your two wide receivers. And those are two really good receivers. I mean, to me, they're both number one receivers. They could be number one receivers on any team in the league. And they are two number ones on this team. So I just kind of feel like Seattle coming off a big win last week, I think they're going to just roll over the Panthers. The Panthers, just not really a good team. They have been scrappy and have been able to put up a fight against some teams this season. But I just kind of feel like Seattle's at home. Seattle's feeling themselves right now. And I think Seattle's going to roll 27-10. Then the Sunday night football matchup is the Miami Dolphins at the Los Angeles Chargers. Right now, the Dolphins are a 1.5-point favorite. And I just really think that's because the Chargers, you just never know what you're going to get from them. But with that being said, since they're coming off of a loss last week, I'm more inclined to actually believe in the Chargers this week. While the Dolphins are also coming off of a bad loss this week, this past week, I really think this is going to be a good offensive battle between Justin Herbert and Tua Tagovailoa. I just kind of really see both teams getting it going offensively. But I'm leaning more towards the Chargers just because that's just kind of how the season has gone, where it's been like they lose one, they win one, they lose one, they win one. And I just think that's kind of how this game's going to go. If you ask me who I trust more in like a game-winning drive, last-second situation, I actually would trust Justin Herbert over Tua in this situation. And I kind of see that that's how this game is going to go. So I just kind of feel like Justin Herbert's going to have a last-minute drive, drive the Chargers down the field, get the game-winning score, and I think the Chargers are going to get the win 28-27. All right, now let's move on to baseball because we had yet another free agent sign this past week. Xander Bogaerts has officially signed with the San Diego Padres, an 11-year, $280 million deal. That is the 12th most lucrative baseball contract in baseball history. And the reason why I bring that up, congratulations to Bogaerts, and also congratulations to the Padres, because who the fuck knew the Padres had this kind of money to spend? Because not only did they have him, even though Fernando Tatis, he started this season off injured and then got suspended for steroids, he got a huge contract last year as well. He's got one of the top 10, he's one of the top 10 highest paid players in the league right now. And he plays shortstop. These two guys both play shortstop. Now, Bogaerts can play both. He can be moved around a bit. And so that's what I imagine is going to happen here. Unless the Padres are thinking about trading Tatis, which wouldn't surprise me. But I don't know. I feel like you kind of want to hang on to him, regardless of the steroid shit in the offseason. Who knew the Padres had this kind of money to spend on two shortstops? They got Soto, and they're spending a lot of money. Just as every team is in Major League Baseball, and hell, every team is in sports, which brings me to basically my rant of the day, because of course, when Aaron Judge signed his $360 million deal earlier with the Yankees, there was of course the Yankee hater pushback, because people have always had an issue with the Yankees just spending their money however they want and always paying for the best players in the league. But guess what? That's their prerogative, and it doesn't always work out either. As a matter of fact, it usually doesn't work out for any team. If you really actually go through the history of the league and look at the highest paid players of all time, pretty much none of them have panned out. But that's not their fault or their problem. But I just have always found it amusing how upset people get about, and it's only in sports for some reason, for the most part. But whenever players get paid a lot, there's always this like pushback from people like, oh, they don't deserve this money, or how much money do you need? And anybody who ever says that quote, how much money do you need? In my personal opinion, I think you need to be strangled to death with barbed wire, because go fuck yourself. You can have as much money as you want, because this is America, and that's how we fucking do in America. I digress, though. This is about sports contracts. And so I found it amusing to see people pushing back mostly on the Aaron Judge contract, and it's really because he signed with the Yankees, but also because he's 30 years old, and in sports, once you hit 30, you are old. Tom Brady is an anomaly. At playing football at 45 just fucking doesn't happen. And that's why we're in awe that he could still do what he could do, because once you hit 30, it's pretty much downhill from there. But you know what? I'm sorry. Did you not think Aaron Judge was not getting paid this year? I mean, really. First of all, the Yankees actually didn't offer him the highest contract. The San Diego goddamn Padres, this team I'm talking about who is spending all this goddamn money like there's no tomorrow, who the fuck knew the Padres had this much money? They offered him a $400 million contract that he did not accept because apparently he wanted to be a Yankee. And guess what? I don't fucking blame him, because if you ask me my choice, 360 go play for the Yankees, or 400 and go play for the Padres, I'm taking Yankees times a million. Because you have at least have a shot at winning something with the Yankees. I don't care what stacked-ass team the Padres have. They ain't proven that they're shit. They ain't shit. And the Yankees are literally the most historic franchise in baseball history. So, of course, you're going to choose the Yankees. But anyways, so you really didn't think Aaron Judge, who has been very consistent throughout his entire career. He's been very good. He's been hitting home runs like no other. And other than the couple of injuries he's had, he's been very consistent and a very solid player. But then he had literally the greatest season in baseball history in God knows how many years, in my fucking lifetime, that's for damn sure. So you mean to tell me that the dude who hit 62 home runs, which is now the American League record, you mean to tell me that dude wasn't getting paid? How fucking stupid are you? Of course he was getting paid. That's why he bet on himself. That's why he had such a fucking amazing season. Of course, dude deserves to get paid, not only because of what he's put in throughout his entire career, but dude was getting paid for this year. Do you know how much money people made off of Aaron Judge in that home run record this year? The fucking Yankees made bank at the end of the season, especially because people wanted to buy tickets. Then all those visiting teams he went to made bank because all the people wanted to catch the home run balls. Then Major League Baseball made bank because more people were watching baseball. So guess what? Aaron Judge deserves to make bank because the motherfucker put asses in seats. I'm sorry, y'all, but it's so fucking annoying to me to listen to people bitch and complain about athletes and their contracts. A, it is not an athlete's fault what the market is. They don't set the market, but I'm sorry, what do you think Aaron Judge is supposed to do when he's in negotiations? Sit there and go, oh, well, you know, I'm 30 years old. I'm coming off of the greatest season, one of the greatest seasons of all time in baseball history. I've been very consistent throughout my entire career of being a great, fantastic baseball player. I think I should probably, you know, take a little less money because I'm 30 years old and all the fucking mouthpieces of the world think I should. Like, go fuck yourself. How stupid are you? If you got an issue with Aaron Judge earning this money, P.S., the owners of all these teams are fucking billionaires. They can afford it. They're making all this money. I'm sorry. All these baseball players and all these athletes deserve their money because that's what the fucking market says they deserve. So, and just to show that, because like, if you think, oh, well, Aaron Judge is 30 years old, this contract's not going to pan out for the Yankees. Let me just read off to you the top 10 highest paid players in Major League Baseball throughout history. The majority of them actually are current players right now because their revenues and their contracts keep going up as they should. There's no issues with that. But so you're going to see a lot of players in the top 10 are still in the league. And then once you actually get down to further down, you'll still see other guys on there in the past history who have had really big contracts. But guess what? The majority of them actually don't pan out and usually don't go on to do anything for their teams that aren't, quote, worth the money or the big money or the contracts that you people are upset about. So let's start off with Mike Trout is the highest paid baseball player of all time. He's currently in a $426 million deal. Okay, Mike Trout was injured like all season. And guess what? The Angels have won absolutely nothing since Mike Trout has been playing for them. Now, me personally, that doesn't matter to me. Mike Trout deserves all the money in the fucking world that he gets because Mike Trout is a great baseball player. But just saying, how many championships has that $400 million bought the Angels? Oh, none. So now let's move on to the second highest paid player in baseball. That would be Mookie Betts, who plays for the Los Angeles Dodgers. He has a $365 million contract. I believe he just signed it last year, the year before. Regardless, now Mookie Betts, he is young, but chances are he's injury prone. He's been injury prone literally his entire career. There's a good shot that he's going to peter out and the Dodgers aren't going to win shit with him either. So then we have Aaron Judge, who's now the third highest paid baseball player in baseball history. $360 million contract, well deserved. Already ranted about why he deserves it. So we'll move on to number four, which is Francisco Lindor, plays for the New York Mets. He has a $341 million contract. He actually has panned out for the Mets. They didn't win anything this year, but overall, he's been a solid player. But he's also injury-prone, and guess how many World Series they've won with him on their team? Oh, that's right, none. Then moving on to number five is Fernando Tatis. He plays for the San Diego Padres, has a $340 million contract. Guess what? He didn't play one game this year because, A, he started off the season on the injured list because he broke his wrist in the offseason riding motorcycles or some dumb bullshit like that. So he missed half the season for some shit like that. And then he also kind of like hid the injury from the team. So there's that aspect. And then the second half of the season, he missed because of testing positive for steroids. So that's the fifth highest paid player in the league. So it sounds like that's really paying off for the Padres, right? Then you move on to number six would be Bryce Harper with the Philadelphia Phillies. Right now he has a $330 million contract. He's spent a lot of his time injured. Now they did get to the World Series this year, and really a lot of that playoff run had a lot to do with Bryce Harper. So yeah, it did pay off this year. But guess what? The first couple of years of that contract, they didn't do shit. And who knows what the rest of his career is going to hold, but he's definitely going to get older and probably going to keep getting injured. But still, no World Series wins have come about from that contract. Moving on to number seven, that would be Giancarlo Stanton with the New York Yankees. He has a $325 million contract. He's pretty much been injured basically ever since he signed that contract. He originally signed this contract with the Miami Marlins, but then they ended up trading him to the Yankees, blah, blah, blah. And he's pretty much been injured, and the Yankees have won zero World Series with him. Then moving on to Corey Sager. Yeah, Corey Sager. Do any of you who aren't baseball fans know who the fuck Corey Sager is? He plays shortstop for the Texas Rangers. He is a really good baseball player. He played for the Dodgers for the most part. But he got a $325 million contract from the Rangers last year. And the Rangers were one of the worst teams in the league this year, just so y'all know. Then we have Garrett Cole of the New York Yankees. He has a $324 million contract as starting pitcher, and they have won zero World Series with him as their starting pitcher. And then rounding out the top 10 is Manny Machado of the San Diego Padres. Oh, what do you know? The Padres now have three of the highest paid players, if you include Manny Machado. I always forget he plays for the Padres for some reason. Like, Machado's an excellent player, and he's way too good for the Padres. But he plays for the Padres. He has a $300 million contract. And how many World Series have the Padres won with Manny Machado in that $300 million contract? The point is, if you just go even further down on that list, I mean, you could go to Albert Pujols. When Albert Pujols got his big contract, he did nothing. He literally petered out and became like one of the most injured players in the league. And really the only reason why he was able to extend his career through this year was because of the designated hitter spot that was added in the National League. So, I mean, you even go back to him and A-Rod, and there's just always players who get these big contracts, and everybody always acts like, oh, is it worth it? Yes, it is worth it. It's just mind-boggling to me that people always have these issues with athletes getting this money, and it's like they don't set the market. They deserve to be paid whatever the market says they deserve to be paid. And you know what? The majority of us, myself included, couldn't even do one day of practice, let alone a game, and let alone a season, and let alone a career. The majority of us couldn't even fucking be a third string backup fucking quarterback in the NFL. Most of us couldn't even make the fucking minor leagues in baseball. These motherfuckers work goddamn hard for this money. And if you got a problem with it, then maybe you should fucking stop watching sports. Because one of the reasons why they get these high contracts is because there's so much revenue coming in for these owners that somebody deserves a piece. And in my opinion, they absolutely deserve a piece. What, you think the fucking Yankees need $360 more million dollars? I don't fucking think so. Aaron Judge deserves that $360 million, and it just so sick and tired of listening to people bitch and complain about how much athletes make. Like, oh, how dare them. As a matter of fact, many years ago, I used to work at a shipping center, basically like a UPS store, but it was privately owned. So it wasn't a UPS store, but I worked there. I managed the store. You know, I'm a sports fan, obviously, so I'm always wearing jerseys, and lots of people would like to come in and discuss sports with me all the time. People still like to discuss sports with me all the time, but when I'd be wearing a jersey, it would always bring up something. And I remember this one asshole in particular, and once I'm done with this story, you're going to see why. He's an asshole, uppity, motherfucking idiot. But I'm just doing my job, and I'm wearing a Kobe Bryant jersey, as is usual with me. And he sees that I'm wearing a Kobe Bryant jersey, and this is when Kobe's still in the league. And I don't know how we get on the subject of how much Kobe Bryant makes, but this Nimrod said, I think athletes like Kobe Bryant make way too much money, and they should give their money to the teachers. And I just stared at him. And you know, there's many retorts going through my brain, but you know, I'm just like, you know what? Sometimes I just let shit go because I don't have the time to argue with you retards about the dumb, moronic bullshit that's spewed out of your idiotic, mouth-breathing mouths. But, so I just stared at him, smiled and nodded, and let him go on his merry socialist, idiotic way. And I just found it amusing because where do you get that retarded mentality? A, why do athletes in particular need to give up their money? But why do they need to give it to the teachers? What the fuck do teachers do? Teachers are literally just babysitters. And if you don't know, I have a complete and utter disrespect for school and teachers in general. I think school and teachers are idiots and a waste of fucking time. I'll tell you what, I didn't learn shit past sixth grade. Anything past sixth grade was a waste of my fucking time. I learned way more at every job I've ever had in my life than I ever learned at stupid fucking school. As a matter of fact, teachers, pre-pandemic, teachers were most known for raping their kids. Literally, teachers were raping kids at record fucking rates pre-pandemic. But yeah, let's give all the athletes money to the almighty fucking rapist, goddamn idiot, high and mighty teacher. And you know what? Teachers know what they're fucking getting into. So I don't see where this moron's logic came from. Now, he was a fucking foreigner. I don't remember where the fuck he came from. I'm pretty sure it was France because that sounds like a fucking uppity, dipshitted France fucking point of view. But when he said that shit, I literally imagined taking barbed wire and strangling him to death with it. That's what I imagined because that kind of mentality is just fucking stupid to me. What the fuck? What the fuck? Oh, Kobe Bryant make too much money. No, he knew you'd give it to teachers. Retard. God. People, shut the fuck up and get over yourselves. If you can't make that money, that's your fucking problem. But just shut up about what athletes make. And it's always about what athletes make. Nobody walks around saying, oh, Bill Gates, he makes too much money. He shouldn't be making that much money. Jeff Bezos, he makes that much money. Oh, the CEO of this company, he makes too much money. It's like, you all sound like retards when it comes to athletes. Like, they don't deserve the money. They do deserve the money. If you just actually look at how much money goes into all the fucking sports, they 100% deserve the money because $360 million don't make a fucking dent compared to what the Yankees are actually worth as an organization. Like I just said about the Padres, they are paying Manny Machado $300 million. They are paying Fernando Tatis $340 million. And now they just added Xander Bogaerts with $280 million. And that's the San Diego Padres, one of the laughingstocks of the league, for Christ's sake. So shut the fuck up. That money don't even make a dent. Gah. Ugh. Sorry. Rant over. Now let's move on to more fun topics. I do have a top five list this week. And it's in honor of the great ref, Mills Lane. He used to be a referee in boxing. If you are a boxing fan, you know who Mills Lane is. As a matter of fact, even if you aren't a boxing fan, you may know who Mills Lane is because he's kind of like he's just one of those people who you would know. I mean, for example, he used to do the voice on this show called Celebrity Deathmatch. He only did it for like the first year because unfortunately Mills Lane suffered a stroke back in 2002. So he's unfortunately been alive for 20 years. Basically as a freaking vegetable. And in my opinion, that's the worst way to live life. I would actually rather be dead than live 20 years as like a mute. Because that's basically what his last 20 years has been. But anyways, he used to do the voice for Celebrity Deathmatch. And then unfortunately, when he suffered the stroke, he couldn't do it anymore. So somebody else took over that role, that voiceover role. But you would know Mills Lane as the guy who says, "Let's get it on." That's what he was always known for. And if you watch a Mills Lane fight, he actually was a really good ref. I know it's really weird to say, oh, a really good ref, because nobody really gives a shit about the refs. But the dude, he was legit. Like, it was no bullshit. And one of these fights in particular, like, dude was in the middle of two big-ass motherfuckers who could just blow his head away with one punch. So, but I mean, just a little background on Mills Lane. Not only was he a ref, but I grew up in Reno, Nevada. So if you're from Reno, you know who Mills Lane is. Not just from his reffing, but he actually was the district attorney at one point, and he was a district judge. He also has a courthouse named after him now because he was a district judge. He even had like a kind of a Judge Judy type of show many years ago as well. So he was just a no bullshit dude. And I kind of feel like most boxing fans, most boxers, like you don't really hear any bad things said about Mills Lane. So I decided this week we were going to do a top five Mills Lane fights because he did officiate many, many good fights. I was able to find five that actually were all five good. One, not so much of a great fight, but it's most certainly an iconic moment. And if you're a boxing fan, I don't even have to say, you know exactly what I'm talking about. But let's get to number five. Number five, Pernell Whitaker versus Azuma Nelson. This took place on May 19th, 1990 in Las Vegas. Now, I have a feeling the reason why I put this at number five is because it was really difficult for me to pay attention to the boxers and what they were doing in the actual fight. Because I was laughing at how 90s this fight was, because it was in 1990, and, well, Pernell Whitaker was, even just thinking about this makes me laugh, was wearing tassels on his ankles. Yes, tassels on his ankles. Like, as I'm watching this fight, I'm like, is this for real? Like, it's like he's a fucking stripper in the ring. Like, he's got tassels on his ankles, and I'm just laughing, because that is so 90s. If you grew up in the 90s, and you remember the 90s, some of the shit we wore was weird, and tassels around your ankles was actually something that was trendy. And Pernell Whitaker, not only did he wear that in the ring, but he boxed with them in the ring. But then you look over at Nelson, and Nelson is so 90s as well, as he is wearing leopard print shorts. Yes, leopard print boxing shorts. Like he was Mel B from the Spice Girls or some shit. So, yeah, it was... I couldn't really focus on the fight just because I was laughing at their attire. But if you were able to focus on the fight and kind of get past what they were wearing, it was a great fight. And I mean, historically, it actually is. Pernell Whitaker, so he ended up winning a unanimous decision in 12 rounds. They went all 12 rounds. Both guys fought great. I mean, it just was a really good, solid fight. But Pernell Whitaker just had what you would call like a magical boxing night. He was perfect offensively, defensively, just all of the jabs. He just delivered what you would call a masterful, perfect fucking fight. And that's why it definitely had to make the list. But I feel like it probably could have been higher on my list. I just didn't focus a lot on the fight because I couldn't get past those tassels on the ankles and those leopard print shorts. It just was so 1990. In that moment, I just couldn't get past it. All right, then at number four on my top five Mills Lane fights is Larry Holmes versus Michael Spinks, part two. This took place on April 19th, 1986. I was the ripe old age of 1 year old. It happened in Las Vegas, it went 15 rounds, and Spinks actually won in a split decision. Now, this was a very controversial scoring title. I mean, really, if you watch it, it was a very close fight. There were no knockdowns in this fight. And so that's kind of, I feel like when there's no knockdowns, it really can throw judges for a loop, because then you're just like, well, who got the better jabs in? Who got the better power punches in? Who got the better of the other? Who was better on defense? Who got this, that, and the other? So it's more difficult. And Spinks did end up winning the fight. Like I said, in a split decision, but, Larry Holmes was pissed. He went off on the refs. I don't think Holmes is alive anymore. I could be wrong. I could be wrong on that, but, he probably to this day would talk shit about how that fight was stolen from him. But really, it was a good fight. I mean, the two of them, they were just trading barbs. And I mean, at the end, and it was the same actually with that previous fight I was talking about between Whitaker and Nelson. To watch two dudes go 12 or 15 rounds and they're still able to just deal blow after blow. And I mean, really, just think about it, because, you know, I'm not a boxer and I hate cardio. I like to work out. I work out every single day, but I don't do cardio. I hate cardio. I've always hated cardio. So I can't, when I'm watching boxing or when I'm watching MMA or basketball or really any type of sport that involves a lot of cardio, I'm just like, how the fuck do they do that? But especially boxers who are going 12 or 15 rounds, like, they're spent by the 15th round. So to watch Holmes and Spinks, like, it was just so crazy to watch them just trade barb after barb. And even in the 15th round, they were still delivering really solid blows to each other, even though they were spent. So I can't even imagine what that is like going 15 rounds. I have nothing but respect. Even if you lose that shit, I have nothing but respect for all fighters who are able to go the distance and just find that strength out of nowhere. Because some of these other fights too that I'm going to talk about in the top two, actually the second one especially, but there's some of these fights where you see dudes and women who are in like the sixth round and it's like they're getting their ass beat, and then all of a sudden they get the second win and it's like, dude, how are you able to do that after like six rounds? And then as it goes on, they get stronger and it's like, man, that's just fucking crazy. But that is what happened between Holmes and Spinks, and I just kind of feel like that's what happened with the judges. But it was a controversial end, and Spinks ended up, he actually won both of those matches. Between he and Holmes. The first one, Holmes was actually undefeated, and Spinks would end up getting that win. Then at number three on my top five Mills Lane fights. Now, this is here just because of how iconic it is. It wasn't really a good fight, at least from one fighter. The other one actually did put up a really solid fight, and I kind of feel like that's why the way it ended is because the other fighter could tell he was just going to get his ass beat. And that would be Mike Tyson versus Evander Holyfield Part 2. This is the ear-biting game. Ear-biting fight. And I mean, I had to include it because this is iconic. No matter which way you put it, no matter what way you look at it, this is one of the most iconic nights in sports history, let alone boxing history. And Mills Lane was the ref right in the middle of it all. And that motherfucker took no shit from these dudes. That's what I'm saying. Like, Mills Lane was not a big dude. He wasn't a bitch, but he was not a big dude, especially when you put him in between Mike Tyson and Evander Holyfield, two big ass heavyweight motherfuckers who can take your head off with one punch. And he put up with no bullshit in this fight. If you rewatch it, because it's been a minute since I've seen this fight. I actually did get to watch it in real time when it actually happened back in the day, when it happened on June 28th, 1997 in Las Vegas. And this was also part two between Tyson and Holyfield. But I mean, like, the two of it's just crazy when you rewatch it. Mills Lane had to, like, break them up multiple times throughout this fight, and he wasn't having any of it. Any of it. He'd be like, get away from each other. Nah, you can't do this. You can't do that. And so, as we all know, how it ended. But really, if you watch the fight, I see why Mike Tyson ended up biting Holyfield's ear. And the reason why is because Holyfield was beating the shit out of Tyson. The first two rounds, obviously, Holyfield won. Now, this did end up going three rounds until, you know, Mike Tyson was DQ'd ultimately in the third round. But the first two rounds, I mean, Holyfield was just going in. And Tyson really, it looked like he was off. It just looked like he was having an off night. And he was getting very frustrated. And then at one point, I believe it was in the third round. It could have been in the second round, actually. But at one point, Holyfield gets a headbutt in, and it opens a cut on Tyson's eye, and it pisses Tyson off because Mills Lane didn't call it. And that was actually the controversy in the first matchup between Tyson and Holyfield. As a matter of fact, Mills Lane wasn't even supposed to referee this match. It was supposed to be another ref who officiated the first match. But Tyson's camp did not want that guy to be the ref because he didn't call a couple of headbutts in the last previous fight. So this time around, he was hoping things would change, and it did not change in this one. And honestly, in my opinion, it wasn't that big of a deal. I see, like, obviously you're going to get pissed off about it, but I mean, really, Mike Tyson was really getting pissed off because he was losing this fight. So we come out in round three, and Mike Tyson actually forgets his mouthpiece to start, so he has to go walk back, pick up his mouthpiece. But he comes out hot, and it's looking like, all right, Tyson's getting back into it. He's gonna at least make this a fight. And then all of a sudden, at one point, he bites Holyfield's ear. And you can't really tell in real time that that's what happened. But all of a sudden, Holyfield just starts jumping up and down and grabs his ear. It's like what fucking happened here? So yeah, you look at replay. Mike Tyson straight up bites Holyfield's ear and takes a piece of cartilage out with it. Now, Holyfield's a motherfucking man. He walks over to his side, and they're just, you know, putting water on the ear, and homeboy's ready to go back out there and fight. And Mills Lane walks over, and, you know, he's really just, he's trying to assess the situation. And so he's like, okay, you know what? Can he still fight? He asks the medical guy. And the medical guy says, yeah. And so he walks over to Holyfield, and he says, can you still fight? And Holyfield's like, fuck yeah, I can still fight. So he's like, all right, we're going to deduct 2 points for the ear bite. You do it again, you're DQ'd. Okay, so we go back, and Holyfield is hot now, as he should be, because part of his ear just got bit the fuck off. And then as they get in another tussle, Mike Tyson tries biting his other ear again. Now, this time he doesn't get as good of a bite, but he does it again. Now, in real time, Mills Lane did not really realize that they had to go back on replay because, you know, they were able to get through the third round. Both guys walked back to their corners, but then Mills Lane realized that that second bite happened. And so he was like, fight over. You are DQ'd. And if you, I mean, really, it's on YouTube. You can rewatch this shit. It is stunning to see the turn of events after this. So DQ'd, and Tyson, of course, gets pissed. And they start kind of Tyson's corner and then Holyfield's corner. All the guys, they start converging in the middle and they start kind of getting in each other's faces. And then Mills Lane is trying to pull them apart. And at some point, eventually, the cops have to get onto the boxing ring. And there's even this one point where you see Mike Tyson like throwing punches at the police. It's just the craziest turn of events, in my opinion. Obviously, with how iconic the night is, it's really also kind of a sad turn of events for Mike Tyson, most especially, because it's kind of like you're watching a person just lose his mind in real time. And not saying you have to feel sorry for him. He doesn't even feel like you all need to feel sorry for him. But I'm just saying, like, rewatching it, because I just watched it the other night, too, just to get ready for this. Rewatching it is very, it's a very sad moment for boxing in general, because for one, Tyson and Holyfield were those dudes at the time, and these were big ass fights. I mean, big ass fights. Tyson, he just was such a draw to all of us. I mean, I'm a Tyson fan, loved watching Tyson fights. And so everybody's eyes are on this fight, and for it to end the way it did, and just to see that they had to be dragged out with cops, and I mean, even as they're walking out of the ring and they're getting out of the ring, Tyson's like trying to fight everybody. And it's just like you're watching a person like lose it in real time. And honestly, that kind of was really the decline of Mike Tyson in his career. So, I mean, it probably was a real breakdown, but it's actually sad to rewatch. But it's an iconic night, and I most certainly had to include it because it's so iconic. But really, if you rewatch it, it's a bad night for boxing in general, because it could have gone down so much better. And to see that somebody actually like bit somebody's ear off, and then like to have cops have to get in the middle, and just to see Mike Tyson like losing his mind as he did, it was just weird to rewatch. But Mills Lane, he took no bullshit in that. I mean, he got in the between the two of them, and he even stood up and said, because they asked him, what made you end this? And he's all like, I told Tyson. He was all like, I'm going to deduct 2 points for this first bitten ear. He's like, I saw his tooth marks in his ear. Of course I'm going to deduct points. But if you do it again, you're getting DQ'd. He did it again and he's DQ'd. Sorry, that's the way I roll. And honestly, that's why we all like Mills Lane, because that's the way he rolls. But real talk, crazy night for boxing, but it has to be on the list because it really is one of the most iconic nights for boxing, no matter which way you look at it. Now moving on to the top two of my top five Mills Lane fights, and these are really fucking good fights. If you have not watched these fights, especially, see, I like number two more than I like number one, but I had to put number one up where I did, just because, especially when you do research on that season and kind of what went down that season, I had to put it number one. Plus, it's the most iconic boxer of all time. So, number two on my top five Mills Lane fights is Marvelous Marvin Hagler versus John Mugabe. Took place on March 10th, 1986 in Las Vegas. And at this point in time, Mugabe was the number one boxer in the world. Marvelous Marvin Hagler is probably one of the most iconic boxers of all time. One of the greatest boxers of all time, hands down. I don't think a lot of fans would really know who he is these days, but he was like the Floyd Mayweather before Floyd Mayweather was the Floyd Mayweather. He just was a knockout king. And what was so impressive to me in this fight was that it looked like, at first, it looked like Mugabe was easily going to win this one. But as the fight rolls on, you could just see Hagler getting stronger and stronger. And as I was saying a bit ago, it's so insane to me to watch fighters like go round for round and sweating. And I mean, you just see the sweat just coming off of them. Like, really, imagine just even if running around in a circle, fucking wind takes the wind out of all of us for the most part. So, like, going as many rounds as these guys go. And this one ended up going 11 rounds. But, like, as it would go on, especially past, the sixth round, Hagler knocked down Mugabe. And he almost got a knockout right there in the sixth round. But Mugabe would end up getting up. And so it would go on to the 11th round. But, like, the sixth round on, Hagler is, it's like he's getting better and stronger as the fight goes on. And it's just crazy to watch. And he's just boom, and he's getting stronger. And his hits are just boom, pound, pound. And he's just getting some great hits in. And finally, in the 11th round, he knocks John Mugabe out and takes the win and is like, fuck you, motherfuckers. I'm Marvelous Marvin Hagler. Give me my belt back, bitch. And it's a fun, like, seriously, if you've not seen this fight and you're a boxing fan, or if you just are not really a boxing fan, but you're not really familiar with it, but you like boxing and you're interested, seriously, go look at Marvin Hagler versus John Mugabe. Beautiful fight from both fighters, for sure. But Hagler, man, he put it on him in 11 rounds. Dude was a beast. So number one on my top five Mills Lane fights, Muhammad Ali versus Bob Foster. This took place on November 21st, 1972, in Stateline, Nevada. Now, since I'm from Reno, Nevada, I know exactly where Stateline, Nevada is. And this is nuts that the greatest boxer of all time, and especially in 1972, because the reason why I put this number one is because of the absolute dominance of Muhammad Ali in the year of 1972. Before he fought this in November, homeboy had fought like six fights in a span of like four fucking months. Who the hell does that? Ain't nobody doing that shit these days. That's like unheard of these days, but not Muhammad Ali. That motherfucker will fight everybody. But the fact that it went down in Stateline, Nevada, of all places, like nowhere, you got to see Muhammad Ali in Stateline, Nevada. And it was like a small, little, tiny ballroom. But also, what was cool about this is basically, it's not Mills Lane's first fight he officiated, but it was one of his first fights he officiated. And if you got Muhammad Ali on your resume, that's fucking dope, especially for boxing, because I kind of feel like if you are a boxer, if you're a boxing fan, if you like boxing, we all got to have some type of respect for Muhammad Ali. This fight was awesome to watch. Now, I haven't watched a lot of Muhammad Ali fights because I'm 37 and most of his entire career was before I was even born. So I've seen a few of them. Of course, The Rumble in the Jungle, my favorite fight of all time. If you have not watched The Rumble in the Jungle, do yourself a motherfucking favor and watch The Rumble in the Jungle. Greatest fight ever. Ever. Anyways, so I've seen that. And then I've seen a couple other just random ones, you know, on ESPN or ESPN Classic. But watching this one was awesome because I got to see the showboating side of Muhammad Ali. Because if you don't remember, what I find really amusing about today's day and age is that everybody likes to like go back in time and say, oh, so-and-so said this like 10 years ago or at the age of 15, they did this and blah, blah, blah. And they want to try and hold it against them. But nobody does that with Muhammad Ali. And if you actually go back in time and look at the shit this dude said about people, you would be appalled. Now, me, I laugh because A, it's boxing, and it to me, it's like a different realm. But the shit he would say about his opponents is fucked up. He would talk about their mamas, their wives. He would call them ugly. He would say the funniest shit about them, but he would also do shit in the ring to piss you off because he was a mind fuck. That was part of the greatness of Ali is that he would fuck with your mind. Not only would he fuck you up in the ring, but he would fuck with your mind. So in this fight, so Bob Foster actually is the title holder in this fight. And Ali was just obviously the better fighter. I mean, Bob Foster, give it up to the dude for really, like, he put up a good fight, but I mean, Ali, like, owned this fight. As a matter of fact, Foster was knocked down 7 times in this fight. But it is the only fight ever that Ali was cut. So, I mean, Bob Foster at least has that on his resume because, you know, Ali don't like that. So yeah, this was the busiest year of Muhammad Ali's career, and here he is in Stateline, Nevada. And before this fight, he even predicted, he's all like, I'm gonna knock him out in 8 rounds. And somebody asks him, well, what if you don't knock him out in 8 rounds? It goes, well, if I don't knock him out in 8, then I guess he's great. He knocked him out in 8. That's what you loved about Muhammad Ali. Motherfucker would always back it up. And what made me laugh so hard in this one is, like I said, I got to actually see the Muhammad Ali showboating in the ring. So first of all, this went 8 rounds. Muhammad Ali would eventually knock out Bob Foster in the 8th round, which is weird because actually the previous round in the 7th round, man, and in the 6th round too. Ali knocked him down. I gotta keep it real. If it was probably in today's day and age boxing, they probably would have stop the fight because, I mean, he was out of it on every single knockdown. He could barely get up. So props to Foster for getting up from these knockouts he was taking. But in the 8th round, Foster was actually getting some pretty decent hits on Ali. But what was really going on is Ali was showboating. And so the one hit he gets in on Ali in his face that cuts Ali in the face, Ali starts pretending he's hurt. And by pretending he's hurt, he's like doing it in like a mocking type way. Like, oh, you hurt me, motherfucker. And what he's doing is he's like wobbling his legs and like shaking in the ring as Foster's like trying to fight him. And he keeps doing it. Like he keeps letting Foster hit him. And he's like, oh my God, like you just hit me. And then boom, Ali delivers the last and final blow and knocks his ass out in the 8th round. It's just funny fucking shit to watch. Oh, God. So shout out to Muhammad Ali and shout out to Mills Lane for having such a great, amazing career. I can't believe Muhammad Ali actually fought in Stateline, Nevada, because when I lived in Reno, growing up in Reno, nobody came to Reno. And so to have somebody the caliber of Muhammad Ali fighting in none other than shitty ass Stateline, Nevada, that's crazy. But what a fight. That's another fight. If you want to see another fight, and it's funny to watch too, because it's from the 70s. So obviously, like, there's no like clock in the corner. You can't really tell what round it is until at the beginning of the round. The replays are funny, and just to go back to the 70s and see how different TV and sports and shit were back then compared to now. It's really funny to watch. But if you really want to see Muhammad Ali showboating, you want to see him dominating, but you also want to see a fighter not give up. You want to see the only fighter who's able to cut Muhammad Ali in fight. You want to watch Muhammad Ali versus Bob Foster, because it was a damn good fight. As I said, you know, Mills Lane, great ref. He's actually in the Boxing Hall of Fame. So, like I said, he is a legendary ref in boxing. It sounds like he had a great life leading up all the way up to his end. And, you know, just it's always fun to rewatch some of these things, too. But it's cool that he officiated well over 200 fights in his career. And so it was obviously hard to figure out which fights to throw in there and pick, but I did it. And these all five were excellent fights, obviously, except for, like I said, the bite fight. That was more just an iconic moment. But hey, man, he got to officiate some amazing fighters throughout his career. And that's pretty dope, if you ask me. So if you haven't seen any of these fights, I suggest you do, because, man, they were great fights to rewatch, and I rewatched all of them, too. Some of them, like the Ali fight was, I think it was like a 45-minute fight. That Hagler fight was near like an hour. You gotta rewatch some of these fights. And even if you you lived through the bite fight, it's interesting to rewatch that, too, because really, when you see the aftermath and when you really just watch it, you're like, damn. Mike Tyson is literally losing it in the ring. Oh, it's just crazy to rewatch. But I love boxing. I actually do love rewatching old fights and stuff and doing research for all my top five lists. So it's always interesting to do that. And it's always fun to do, just especially on boxing, because usually you can find the entire fight. And as I mentioned, I have such respect for fighters and fighters who can go the 12, the 15 rounds and just be completely gassed and still delivering blow after blow. So RIP Mills Lane, and you all have a great weekend. Enjoy the weekend of sports, and I will talk to you motherfuckers on Monday.